Hello and welcome to the Lebanese Politics Podcast. My name is Benjamin Red, joined by Nizar Hassan as always. Nizar, it's good to be back.
Yeah, it's been so long. I'm so excited and I miss doing this podcast, honestly.
Absolutely, absolutely. Me too. We were talking about this earlier. We felt like, okay, the elections are coming up next month, May 15th. The Lebanese Politics Podcast started out really as an elections podcast 4 years ago in 2018. And so we really felt like, all right, we've got to come back. We've got to do at very least a limited series about the elections because a lot's gone on over the past 4 years. There seem to be so many changes that have happened at such sort of a dizzying pace here in the country. It's actually a little bit confusing and a little bit bewildering looking at the elections coming up and trying to understand what exactly is going on. Now, I would have loved for Taimur to be with us. Unfortunately, well, fortunately for him, he got a great job. He's the deputy head of the Reuters Bureau now here in Beirut. He's working alongside Maya Jubaili, absolute dream team. I'm very excited for them. But unfortunately, that also means he's not going to be a co-host for these episodes. And another big loss for us, Susan Wilson, our longtime producer, who's produced every single episode of our podcast. She also moved on. And we wish her all of the luck in the world.
And we will miss her, like, telling us off in the recordings for sure.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
There's no one that keeps us under control like our producer, Susan.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if the quality drops slightly during this episode and subsequent episodes, you can blame Nizar because he's taking on all of the responsibility of editing.
Thank you, Ben. That's a very nice way of introducing this. Anyway, it's really good to be back because, as you were saying, we're at a very historic moment in Lebanon where a lot of things have changed and we're at kind of a crossroads. Last election, when it happened, 2018, we were before the economic and financial collapse that we now know as kind of self-evident reality in Lebanon. So the situation was obviously drastically different. And the point of this episode specifically is to look at how things have transformed and what is the new socio-political environment that we are heading into the elections in.
Absolutely. And after this episode as well, just so that you, our listeners, know, we are going to be doing 3 more episodes before the actual election. Our usual release time is Sunday night at midnight, but we're, because of the actual elections, we're going to move that, and all of the episodes after this will be released actually Friday night at midnight for the next 3 until the elections. And then after the elections, we will come back with 1 more episode, and we'll try to get that to you as soon as we can, but at the very latest, Friday after the elections at midnight. But yeah, that's the big picture of what we're doing with this limited run coming back to the airwaves. But this episode, like you said, Nizar, there's been so much that has gone on over the past 4 years. We thought it would be a good idea to sort of step back and set the scene. All right, so taking a very sort of macro picture, what exactly has changed from 2018? What hasn't changed? What similarities can we still find between these elections that are coming up and those that we covered 4 years ago? And one of the things that hasn't changed, right, is the electoral law and just the technicalities that go along with this. You'll remember back in 2018, there was this new electoral law that introduced proportional representation, which had been a long time in the making. It was the first time in Lebanese history that they had actually used proportional representation rather than the first past the post system. So 4 years ago, they came out with the system, or actually 5 years ago, the law was passed the year before. They came out with the system. It broke the country into 15 districts. And within those districts, you had proportionality applied, but it didn't end up working out as a super successful proportional system, because you're splitting the vote down into these. I mean, Lebanon is already a small country, and you're splitting it into 15 different districts, And that made the electoral threshold, the percentage of the vote that you have to get in order to enter parliament, sky high, right? So just like in 2018, this year we have the same law. It's still, you know, the very best case scenario, the lowest electoral threshold that you can find is in Choufalet, and that's at 7.7%, which is higher than, you know, what most proportional systems use. But that's the lowest right to enter parliament. In other districts, you go as high as 20%, which is, you know, makes it very difficult for minority parties to sort of break into the system.
And also it makes a vote less valuable in one area compared to another. This is a very important feature of the law, because when you're saying 7% versus 20% threshold, what we mean by that is percentage of votes you need in order to actually get a representative. So when you need 20%, then an individual vote is simply less valuable, has less weight.
Right, right. And we're really only scratching the surface. I don't want to go through the entire electoral law and explain everything. If you do want to listen to more about the electoral law, then you can go back to actually our first episode ever of the podcast. We talk a bit more about it, and we especially get into some of the quirks, the things like the sot tafdili, the preferential vote, which really... throws some curveballs into the strategy for various lists and for individuals on that list. It's almost like you're running against people who are on the same list as you. So if you want a full discussion of all of the ins and outs of that, go back and listen to that. But we're not going to retread that, because this is one of those things that is the same as 4 years ago. And the other thing about this, thing that is the same that should have been different was the expat vote. The expats, you know, Lebanese who live abroad, they were allowed to vote 4 years ago. And it's
in their home districts.
In their home districts. Now, in this election, it was supposed to go up. They were supposed to get their own six representatives, six seats of parliament that they would vote for. Right. And so instead of having 128 members of parliament, it was going to go up to 134 members of parliament. And then like later on, it would go back down. But that's not happening at all. It's just going to happen exactly like it did in 2018. If you're an expat and you're voting, then you're actually going to be voting in whatever district you are registered in.
But what really changed is how many expats are actually interested in voting. Right. Because back in 2018, we only had 82,000 people registered to vote for this election. Today, we have 244,000. So the size of the expat vote, the value it has, or the weight it has in the election, has increased.
Yeah, it's basically tripled. So we'll have to see how that all plays out. The expats are scheduled to vote on May 6th or May 8th, a little bit earlier than everybody else. And then I think election workers are on May 12th, and then the vote here in Lebanon on May 15th.
But even if you're an expat, by the time you vote, we will hopefully help you kind of make an informed choice based on what the scene is, who are different people running, their alliances, their programs, etc.
Absolutely. That is the idea. In looking back, you know, we think, oh, there are all of these major changes that have legitimately happened. You know, the Thawra, the financial collapse, the Beirut blast, things that have very much changed the way that a lot of people actually live here in Lebanon. But, you know, in preparing for this podcast, you know, and going back to what the situation was 4 years ago, a lot of economic concerns, a lot of concerns about corruption within the state, a lot of that was there already. Lebanon had, an opposition, a fairly vibrant one. You know, you were involved last election round, as an activist and a volunteer, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was a civil society in the political sense that was active, in the sense of new groups emerging, new political parties emerging, movements that don't identify as parties, etc. The scene was not empty or anything. But sometimes it's hard for us to really understand or to live back the moments, because when time passes, concerns and discourse change. And right now, when you're looking at things heading into the election, you're getting all of this inflow of information and speeches and statements and programs and lists, etc. And they are all mostly focused on the present moment. So it's very helpful sometimes to just step back and see what we were thinking back then and how things evolved so that we got to this present moment, because it's not detached from the past. This moment right now, politically and economically, is a continuation of what has been happening in the last 30 years, but more specifically of what has been happening in the last 3-4 years.
Right. And how much has actually changed in the last 4 years? Has it been enough that actually, you know, has consequences, especially political electoral consequences? So if we go back to 2018 and the elections there, I think a good place to start is just in the run-up. There was a big conference in Paris, the CEDRA conference, Paris 4, where the international community pledged $11 billion to help Lebanon through its, you know, economic problems that it was going through at the time, in exchange for a whole lot of reforms, really big major reforms, which kind of sounds like what's going on today, but perhaps at a different scale. So if we rewind back to then, if you'll remember, April of 2018, the CEDRA conference happened, and politicians and everybody knew that there was a huge problem and that things really needed to change with the Lebanese economy and with the way that the government managed it.
Yeah, totally. So by 2018, so that no one kind of forgets, by 2018, we already understood that the Lebanese economic model doesn't work, that there is a structural problem. The main things that identified this problem, some people call it triple deficit syndrome or whatever, it's basically the economy overall being in a huge trade deficit, which means much more dollars leave it than enter it. The other problem was that in order to finance this economy, Lebanon has been borrowing lots and lots of money for high interest rates for long years. Back in 2018, it was already known that the public debt was a bit too large to be paid back by Lebanon because its value was bigger than the Lebanese economy itself. And this debt was being accumulated partly because the state was burdened by paying back this debt. So it was accumulating budget deficits every year, trying to pay back a huge lot of money. So it was clear that this was an unsustainable model. In the elections of 2018, as you were saying, they came at the against the backdrop of the Sadr conference. We remember Saad al-Hariri going on stage and promising 900,000 jobs, which was back then, you know, seen as ridiculously as it's seen today by most, maybe experts. But at that point, there was some sort of political discourse from the elite, from the establishment, that we're going to save this country, we're going to invest, we're going to, you know,
right,
put this thing back together. The same kind of discourse that was around Paris 1, 2, and 3, when they were borrowing money for the same purposes, but also increasing the problem on the long term.
Right. Like, we can fix this. You can trust us to fix this. It's going to be a tough fix, but vote for us. And we are going to make a bunch of reforms. We're going to do a bunch of reforms that you may not like all of them, but we have to do it in order to keep the system together. And you can trust us to make sure that all of this happens.
Yeah, exactly. What happened following the elections was the formation of a parliament that kind of had a majority for March 8 forces, like kind of generally defined, you know, Hezbollah and its allies, Syrian regime and its allies, etc. But not a big majority of any kind.
And it's also important to note here that the opposition candidates, only one actually made it into parliament, Paula Yaoubian in East Beirut. That was the only one for all of this talk of civil society and, you know, distrust in the elite and maybe people will be switching their votes. It didn't really pan out too well.
Yeah, and it was a reality check for most of these opposition groups to realize that they're doing something wrong. There's something to be, you know, revised in how they're doing and how they're approaching elections and politics. So it was a very important moment in kind of paving the way for the politics we have today.
All right. So after the election, this election where the political parties had said, oh, you know, we've got to do something. We need to do something quite drastic. What happens? They renominate Saad Hariri for another term as prime minister. But then nothing happens, at least on a political level, for 8 months. It takes him from May of 2018 until the end of January 2019 to form a government. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, on the ground, things are starting to become a little bit more clear about just the severity. A little bit more clear, not fully clear, but a bit more clear about the severity of the crisis facing the country.
Yeah, by that point, it was clear that a serious financial crisis is imminent. It's coming soon. And if you hear any meows, it's my cat who wants to go into the studio. So just ignore it.
We've got a sidekick this episode.
He wants to be part of it. I understand. Anyway, so back then, it was clear that something was coming. We had the McKinsey report, which was leaked by back then...
Raad Khoury, the economy minister.
And this McKinsey report had been commissioned a while ago, back in 2017, just before Hariri got, you know, kidnapped, quote-unquote, in Saudi Arabia. And this may be also important to note, this kind of signaled the moment the relationship between Hariri and Saudi Arabia became very shaky. Meanwhile, on the economic level, we had, as we said, the McKinsey report, which said the economic model in Lebanon doesn't work. We had Goldman Sachs actually publishing a report also saying that when the crisis happens, you know, because it's almost inevitable, bondholders, those who own public debt in Lebanon, are not expected to get more than 35 cents to the dollar. So 35% of what they own. This already kind of shook things up. And we also later had a news piece in Al-Akhbar talking about how Ali Hassan Khalil, our finance minister back then, was talking already, discussing plans to restructure the debt. And this back then were still things that were kind of taboos for the Lebanese establishment to talk about on the economic level. And there wasn't really any serious critique of the policies of Riyad Salami back then. You know, you remember he has been glorified throughout the last 30 years as a savior of the Lebanese economy. It's always good to remember that it was really different. The situation was really different economically back then. But we knew an economic crisis was imminent. It's going to happen soon.
So following these revelations in 2019, we start to see a bit of a destabilization of the exchange rate. First, starting out around April, it goes off of the peg. The lira has been pegged since 1998. You know, it traded within a band of 1,500 lira to the dollar, up to 1,515 lira per dollar. And it went up to, you know, a bit outside of that band starting in April. And then as the summer progresses and we go into August, we start seeing that number growing, meaning the lira is weaker against the dollar. It takes more lira to buy just $1. And then on top of this, we start seeing some issues with certain imports that are very important, like fuel. And you have you start seeing instances where, you know, gas station owners say, hey, we're going to shut down the gas stations. We're talking pre-Thawra, pre-financial crisis proper. But we could see this start to happening, and the value of the lira was starting to weaken, you know, just a bit at first, and then quite a bit more going in August, September. We started seeing protests as well on the streets. And all of this led to, like, people were genuinely concerned, you know, what the hell is going on?
And the government knew that it had to do certain things in order to get the Sadr money we were talking about, or hoping to, which never happened, to be clear. The government needed to pass a budget. So in mid-2019, the parliament passed a budget for 2019, which is hilarious. You don't pass a budget for the year you're already spending money in. You pass a budget for next year. But as the Lebanese budget processes go, this is even better than some of the other years we've had.
Absolutely. Getting it done is better than not doing it all.
Yeah. So although the exchange rate was still acceptable back then, the government had realized very clearly that it needs to lower spending or bring in new revenues in order to justify a more balanced budget in order to get the money. So after passing the budget, which, if you remember, was primarily revolving around reducing some spendings and postponing a lot of infrastructure projects like a road, a highway, etc., things that cost
money.
Which
is a common trick for these budgets in order to save money. Oh, we've got these projects, we'll just, like, put off, you know, funds for these big infrastructure projects.
Exactly. And by the 1st of October, the central bank had to step in this whole situation. The central bank stepped in with a circular saying, I'm going to support the import of wheat, medicine, fuel, you know, the necessities for survival in a sense. So there was already discussion around whether the subsidies will stay or not. This is also new to Lebanon because for a while we have been, everything had been subsidized based on the peg between the Lebanese lira and the dollar, but also through specific subsidies such as fuel, such as wheat, etc.
And essentially this was a tacit admission by the central bank that, oh no, there kind of are two exchange rates now. There's the official one that we will defend for these, you know, categories of, you know, very important things, wheat, medicine, fuel. And then there's everything else.
Exactly.
Which is illegal and doesn't exist, but it does.
So by mid-October, the government passes some taxes, some regressive taxes to basically increase revenue. The most famous of those was the WhatsApp tax that we talked about before. I think most of our listeners are familiar with it. And obviously, it never went through. Obviously, nothing went through because this was the moment when everything collapsed for this government. It was actually the day after that we knew about these taxes and that the protests start in what turned out to be the uprising of 17 October 2019. We will talk more about the uprising and how it impacted politics in the later parts of this episode and in future episodes for sure, because it's still a very important historic moment or crossroads for Lebanon. But coming back to the economic side, there was a focus on economic issues, but still it's not very politicized at that point. We had heard certain discourses from opposition movements around التوزيع العادل للخسائر or the fair redistribution of costs from the crisis. So the realization that the crisis already happened, that probably many of the deposits are not coming back in full, all of these things had already been in many minds, and economic journalists like Mohammed Zbib, people like Sharbel Nahas had been warning and talking about it for a while.
And the bank's closure during the, you know, the first couple of weeks after the Thawra erupted, that led a lot of people that just amplified their fears of, oh my God, how bad is this? You know, are we going to be able to get our money out, and in what shape?
Yeah, it was, people are often confused what happened in these dates. It was after the protest that the banks decided that we will shut down, and they shut down for 12 straight days. And during these 12 days, it was not a normal situation. The country was on fire because of all the protests everywhere. Roads are blocked. General strikes imposed in different ways by blocking roads all over the country, etc. So it was a particular situation. But the banks had different excuses for not coming back to work, like, oh, people are threatening our security, or another time it was our employees want to go on strike because they're afraid of people's aggression, and these different excuses. But what we know now for sure is that the banks were very concerned about their liquidity, you know, how many dollars they have and how much they can give away. And that's primarily, you know, the motivation behind shutting down the doors. And as you said, it created as an environment of anxiety, especially that people were not able to withdraw their dollars from ATM in many situations, etc. So it was clear that something drastic was happening on the financial level.
This was exactly what had caused things to happen in the first place, right? So the focus had been so much on really the government and, you know, how much debt and, you know, sovereign debt there was, and could the government repay that? But then once you take one step further back, you see banks' exposure to the government, the central bank's exposure to the government, banks' exposure to the central bank.
And when we talk about exposure, it means how much money it has lent, and therefore how much money it's expecting back from these institutions.
Right. This fundamentally goes back before the banks closed, before the Thawra, and you see that, oh, right, the banks were starting to restrict dollars before October 17th, for sure, and that is actually what made importers start going to the Sarafin, the money changers, instead of the banks, which was why the lira peg failed in the first place, which is why we saw the deviation from the 1500 peg up to by September 26th of 2019, almost a month before the protests broke out. That's when the lira hit 1600 on the parallel market, according to data from Omar Tamo, who's now at Bloomberg. So you can see that really this all of these economic anxieties and everything that sparked the tower ended up revealing a much deeper rot that not a lot of people were really paying attention to. Maybe there were some whispers here and there about it, but it was a pretty well-kept secret that the banks themselves and the financial system itself and the central bank itself, they weren't, you know, fully solvent.
So less than 2 weeks into the protests, into the uprising, Saad Hariri resigns, his government resigns, and there is no more active government in Lebanon, which means there are no serious public policies to be made to deal with the urgent situation. Hariri tried to hold talks with politicians like Basil and others around forming a new government. This failed. And also this, if you remember, what's not even acceptable in the streets at all. Like, you know, Hariri himself became kind of a symbol of the establishment and was rejected by most protesters. So it was not very feasible for him to come back at that point.
He was meeting with Basil, who, you know, the most famous slogan that came out of the Thawra was, you know, directed quite personally at Basil.
Yeah, both of them not very popular people, so to see them negotiating over a government is not very exciting for anyone. But many potential prime minister names were being floated around. Hariri and Hezbollah at some point, Hezbollah and Amal, obviously, they work together, they usually negotiate together. Hariri and the Thunai, they sit down together and they say, okay, let's agree on Mohammad Safadi. You know, you can look at this guy up. We've talked about him before. Politician slash businessman, part of the bourgeoisie class that came to Lebanon, into Lebanese politics, mostly after the civil war, along with Hariri, Issam Faris, and others. Anyway, they talk about Safadi. 2 days later, Safadi's like, I'm not into this whole thing. I'm out of question, because he knew that people in Tripoli, his home city, and everywhere in Lebanon were not just going to accept another face of the establishment to be prime minister. This is why they went with a new face, Hassan Diab, who was designated prime minister in December, and within a month he was able to form a government. The premise behind this government was that it was not a political government. What it was, that it's a technical or technocratic government that's here to fix things. But we know from how it was formed and the political quotas within it and the sectarian quotas within it that it was a government that was not really technocratic in the sense of independent from political will. There was representation of most parties inside the government.
It's an interesting government because it, and on the one hand, it seemed to sort of give plausible deniability to these political powers that wanted to say, oh, no, we're not in the government anymore. It's independent technocrats that are running things. But then along with that, you actually get some somewhat technocratic minded people in this government who tried to actually then push for the necessary reforms. So this government actually makes the decision to default on Lebanon's Eurobonds. That's dollar-denominated debt owned by the government. There's a big debate about this, but this is something that they actually did, and they got done. They said, no, we have limited dollars. We are not going to use them to pay back creditors. Instead, you know, we've got to preserve as many dollars in the country as possible, because that's the problem. They also came out with an actual plan, right, to tackle things. And in that plan, they looked at how in debt and how much in the hole the financial sector, the government, BDL, et cetera, were, and put numbers to it.
Yeah. And numbers, as we will see in a second, became the most kind of controversial political thing in the country at that second, because it entailed a fight between the government and other state institutions. But it's important to remember that the banks were also taking their own decisions during this time. And for example, by the beginning of April, they had stopped allowing all USD withdrawals from what we now call LOLER account or Lebanese dollar account, which for a while had been limited to small numbers, you know, small amounts every week. But at that point, it was like, you're not getting any greens from your dollar account. This is over.
And it varied bank to bank, right? There was no uniformity of this process in these early days.
Yeah, exactly. And although the government's default did not impact the exchange rate drastically, partly because it was not a surprise, you know, because we had been, yeah, it happened gradually from the beginning of March, from the first week of March till the end of it, or the last week of it. And also, there was a certain consensus that anyway, we're going to stop paying soon. So it was about when to stop and how to default, etc. It did not impact the exchange rate, but what did is a series of decisions by the central bank around that time. And in April, for example, central bank issued two decisions that basically organize how people withdraw from the dollar account in Lebanese lira, what we have called lirafication, the process in which the only way you have access to your dollars is if you withdraw them in lira. And when you withdraw them in lira, you're withdrawing them at the rate that is determined by the central bank. So if the rate changes, or if there's a big gap between this rate and the real exchange rate in the market, you're getting a huge haircut on every single withdrawal that you're making from your account. So by the end of April, the exchange rate had actually hit 4,000. And the response from the ruling elite or the government back then was, okay, let's crack down on exchange shops. They were blaming exchanges, you know, people who trade in currencies, for the exchange rate fluctuation or depreciation. Obviously, there were a lot of critiques to this attitude, including on our podcast by guests, just to remember that. But generally, there was this crackdown, and they forced most exchangers to close for a while as well. And meanwhile, the government was, in the beginning of May, preparing to start the talks with the IMF. The talks with the IMF were the most important thing that the government could do. It was one of its most important mandates. Why? Because the main crisis is the lack of dollars. The IMF is the international bank that lends you dollars in this type of crisis.
And most actors on the scene really didn't see any way around a deal with the IMF. So, I think there was a pretty broad consensus, although there are always some dissenters, but a pretty broad consensus that, okay, no, we kind of have to go through a program with the IMF. I mean, obviously, we have to fix what has gone wrong within the system, make potentially painful reforms in order to get this money from the IMF, because there really isn't another option out there. So, the country's so deep in the hole.
Exactly. But meanwhile, prices were getting out of control and people started becoming seriously concerned about their ability to afford basic necessities in life. So the question of what government is subsidizing or not became very central. And this is when the government issued a list of things that it supports, you know, a list of products, even specified by specific brands that you can go and get, which are subsidized at a rate that the government determines, which was back then, you know, a bit more than double the official rate, around 3,200 lira.
Right, but they kept the subsidies on the really important things, the wheat, medicine, fuel, at 1,500, right? And so you had this sort of stratified tiering of different subsidies and like three different exchange rates all of a sudden.
Exactly. So after the government kind of stood on its feet and started doing all of these things, primarily the main fight or the main reason this government was not able to achieve anything was a conflict between the government and its so-called independent experts, etc., and the banks on how to deal with the crisis. Primarily, what is the size of the crisis, you know, in terms of how much losses there are, as we were saying, the numbers. And while the government was actually negotiating with the IMF, there were people in the negotiating team representing different agendas. This was really crazy because you had people representing Riyad Salemi and the banks saying one thing, and then we had Hassan Diab's advisors and the government saying another thing. This meant that the IMF talks had to collapse, because otherwise the IMF cannot deal with, you know, you cannot deal with another party that doesn't have a clear agenda. It doesn't. Its own delegation is not in agreement on what to do.
Right, and we ended up seeing some very high-profile members of that Lebanon's team, IMF negotiations team, resign: Henri Charoul, Alain Befeni, and that really was just sort of like the collapse. We had this drive within Hassan Diab's, you know, first few months towards, you know, reforms and all this stuff, actually, you know, trying to fix things. And then everything just crumbles with these IMF negotiations.
Exactly. And what looked like a thing between Diab and Riyad Salemi was much bigger than that. It was a question of economic agenda, primarily. We have to also note here that after the crackdown on exchange shops and all of that, things were a bit, you know, chaotic for a while. But then the shops were open and the exchange rate skyrocketing to reach 8,000 for a dollar by June. The fluctuation of or depreciation of the lira was seen by Hassan Diab's government as kind of a political conspiracy to force it into certain action or to put blame on it, etc. The politics and the economics at that point were literally one thing, you know. And the conflict over the numbers and how to look at the crisis and what to do about it was taken to another level when the parliament intervened and created a fact-finding committee, اللجنة تقصي الحقائق, to say, we studied the number of the government and we don't agree with them. And we think that the crisis losses are very overestimated and exaggerated in the government plan. And what this means in reality is that they're saying the banks and the central bank should not carry the cost that you are talking about in your plan. So by minimizing the losses, they are thinking about the future of how much they will pay back and how much they will lose. Because if Hassan Diab's plan was approved and went through, this would have meant changes to the structure of the banking sector itself and the ownership of it, because in that plan there were many items revolving around what happens to bank ownership when there are so many depositors you can't, you know, pay back. So these depositors might become owners or shareholders in that bank. It was a very interesting conflict that was happening. This conflict and the fact that it kind of faded away later was perhaps because Riyad Salemi and the political elite that is allied with the banks had an opponent in the government back then, and they never did again.
Right, right. Of course, all of this, though, it came to this crashing end with the end of the IMF negotiations in the summer. But then something else happened shortly thereafter. August 4th, the Beirut port explodes. We have covered this extensively on the podcast. Obviously, very huge deal, and this was, you know, the nail in the coffin. It brought down Hassan Diab's government. I think 6 days later, he resigned. And it really did mean, you know, his reform plans had already been ended, well, now they were definitely over because he was now out of power.
Yeah, exactly. And after Hassan Diab resigned, there was an attempt to form a government by Mustafa Adib, if you remember that guy. He failed to form a government, and then Hariri tries again and fails to form it.
And it's interesting here as well, because Adib, to his credit, you know, he got in there, he figured out, I'm not going to be able to do this, and he resigned, you know, about a month later. But Saad Hariri, he was designated in October to form a new government. And then we see another slide happen. Because he was trying to form a government with Michel Aoun for, you know, the next several months. It stretched all the way till July. And what happened during this period?
This is when the exchange rate depreciation got to a whole new level. So between February and the end of June, we went from 9,000 to the dollar to 17,000. Okay, so that's a 91% decline since before the crisis. Which means that anything imported that you are buying from the Lebanese market costs 10 times as much as it used to before.
Yeah. And so we have yet again this period of just this very long period of stagnation where everything is just getting a bit worse. But if you look at it, if you take a step back and look at it, you see, oh, there was no government. There's nothing really being done on any sort of policy level. And we just see everything in the country getting much, much worse. And we also had problems with, you know, fuel imports and lines for gasoline. And
medicine shortages.
A whole myriad of things that were just going wrong. And there was nobody really that could fix it.
Yeah. And finally, in July, Hariri said, okay, I can't do this anymore. He withdrew. He resigned, and Miqati was brought in 1 month later. Najib Miqati, needless to introduce, a huge billionaire, owner of multinational companies with his siblings, etc. Politician from Tripoli in Lebanon. And he kind of represents a certain kind of middle ground between different political factions in a way. He was brought in July 2021, and he in around 46 days, he forms a new cabinet. And this cabinet received the support of all major political forces except for the Lebanese forces, which had, you know, Lebanese forces had resigned from Hariri's government before Hariri resigned himself in the early days of the Thawra. And right now they were portraying themselves as opposition.
Of course, by the time that Mikati got into office in September and won parliament's confidence also in September, it was, you know, the end of 2021. Oh, elections are right around the corner. And so Mikati essentially came in as everybody, the people who I have spoken to, at least, they saw it as, oh, no, this is an elections government. But that's it. You know, yeah, he can try to fix a few things around the edges, but he doesn't have enough time. This cabinet doesn't have enough time to actually implement any real reforms. So they maybe can get the ball rolling on a few things, but what their primary purpose is not to actually deal with the problems. It's to make sure that the elections happen in a few months' time.
Yeah. And to give a certain political sense for that also, it's the fact that Lebanon went through all of these historical moments like the Thawra and the Blast. It was seen kind of as a requirement for any economic solution in Lebanon to have an election. So even like foreign actors like Macron, who had a couple of initiatives trying to form some kind of consensus government, and other foreign actors are keen on knowing that the people they are lending money to, the government they are lending money to, will be a government that's supported by a kind of democratic mandate, in a sense. So that's why the elections also economically are super, super important. It's a question of mandate and getting money from abroad. But what I want to stress right now is that we had 3 years, okay, since the elections in 2018 to this point that we're talking about, which was summer 2021. 3 years, and nothing was done to even help relieve the symptoms of the economic crisis or fix its structural. But how crazy is it to think about it right now that 3 years after realizing that we're going into a very serious crisis that will change Lebanon forever, we still had zero action from government and people in power, action that actually, you know, helps in the situation.
Right. To quickly recap, you know, there were three governments over the past 4 years. We had Saad Hariri, his first government. It took forever to form. And then they didn't end up moving nearly as quickly as they should have before things, the bubble just sort of burst in late 2019. He had to resign. Then we have the second government coming in, Hassan Diab. They try to actually launch some reforms, but are stymied by other political actors, it seems, and other elements of the state. And then they ultimately also have to admit defeat and resign following the Beirut port explosion. And then we have another period of long stagnation of Hariri trying to form a government is ultimately unsuccessful. And then eventually Mikati gets in. But by then, by that point, it's time to prepare for the elections. So three governments, what's been done? Have the Cedar funds been tapped? No. Has there even been, you know, like a capital control law that's passed? Well, they're getting closer to it, but nothing's happened.
This capital control law was required maybe on day one of the crisis. You know, like it was not even a question whether we need a capital control law or not. But we remember that Nabih Berri said, rest in peace, capital control law, at some point, that the parliament members associated with the financial elite fought it to make sure that a good agenda is not implemented. This is what we talked about with Alain Bifani in episode 93. The do-nothing policy, the policy of doing nothing, was actually the economic agenda of a financial elite and a political elite that's trying to survive the crisis by acquiring as much as possible, by letting go of as many costs that they will have to pay in the crisis, and making sure they have access to resources and facilities after the crisis, when things are cheaper, when they can rebuild their wealth again in a way that keeps them in power. So this do-nothing policy was not arbitrary if we look at it from a macro perspective. What happened is that A lot of people left the financial system. Why? Because they were forced to close their bank accounts in some cases in order to withdraw money from them. In other cases, they just withdraw all of the money that they had in lira because they have no other good source of income. Some people wrote checks from their accounts to buy real estate, depending on your class. But a lot of people used a lot of this money. And a lot of people left the financial sector, which in general is a terrible idea because you will need to re-penetrate these people into the financial sector in the future. And that's a requirement to know really what kind of economy you're dealing with. And the capitalist.
Right, and a lot of the times, the people who are leaving the financial sector, they are doing it by means of a haircut. The one policy response that we do see from any Lebanese state institution really is from the central bank itself that put out these circulars, 151, 148, etc., that allowed people to take their money out, but like with a cost, essentially. And what became like a steeper cost as the lira depreciated. That's really the only, mitigating policy that we see. It's from BDL. Meanwhile, normal people are trying to get their life savings out of the banks. A lot of them can't get it all out of the banks, obviously. And if they do get it out of the banks, they're taking a haircut. Prices are going through the roof. Triple digit inflation going on. The minimum wage is not amended. Nothing changes on that front. Social safety nets. Oh, things are announced that, we're working on XYZ. But I think it was only just last month in March when they finally announced that the ESSN program, which is a World Bank funded social safety net program, was actually able to get off the ground. That's a month ago. It took that long to actually get this thing up and running. The promised ration card program, which is an even bigger program that was supposed to be around to help people out, that's no one knows still where the money is going to come from. And so for people on the ground, what are they seeing? They all of a sudden, their wages are worth far less. They don't have electricity nearly to the same degree as they used to have. They can't get fuel oftentimes, or they can't afford it now that subsidies have been lifted off of fuel. And there is zero response to actually helping these people out.
Yeah, and one more thing to note about what the central bank has done during this time, because I hear a lot of people still stuck in this binary of like, should we criticize Salemi or not? Should we target him or not? I mean, please, just look at the last 3 years and see what the central bank has done and the impacts of these decisions. Allowing people only to withdraw in lira from dollar accounts means that a lot of these people are getting the lira out and going buying dollars. The lira will lose its value because people have demand for dollar and not for lira. This is like basic. And when we talk about a drastic decline in people's ability to buy things because of this exchange rate issue primarily, we're talking about a whole society getting poorer. When society gets poorer, it imports less. It pays less on imports. So automatically, you're fixing, quote unquote, in the worst way maybe, but you are fixing some of the trade imbalance that you had, or the trade deficit, where the Lebanese society is just now too poor to be able to afford whatever it was importing before. That's why I was saying it's not an arbitrary thing. It is an economic agenda because Riyad Salemi knew, and people around him knew, that when time passes with these all of these policies, not only will he get rid of a lot of people who are still waiting for their money from the banks, because not only are more and more people leaving the banking system, as we said, but also we reach a point where they can use this current reality, which is society is poorer and trade deficit is less than before, to change the kind of the prescriptions for what to do following this reality. And this is the trickiest part of this episode that I want to stress on. The elections, the current political environment, the Lebanese government today is almost totally tied to the money situation. The survivability of the Lebanese system is tied to how it can finance itself. So this is why a conflict around the losses and what to do following the crisis is primarily what determines kind of the fate of Lebanon in the coming 10, 20, 30 years.
Absolutely. And the other thing, though, with this sort of policy of doing nothing is that it potentially impacts the legitimacy of these political actors. So all of these Sulta politicians before were talking about Sidra and, you know, 900,000 jobs and all of this stuff. And then they couldn't actually deliver on any of these things, and beyond just not delivering on them, then they allowed the situation to get so bad that it burst everything out into the open, and Lebanon saw this precipitous, you know, decline financially and economically. And that was manifest quite clearly, I think, in the Thawra, right? It was, hey, we elected you guys to actually do something. You don't have any legitimacy, you know, anymore. And then it was sort of reiterated, I think, by the Beirut blast. You know, yet again, the politicians were unable to, at best, they were unable to stop a huge explosion at the port that, you know, killed hundreds of people. At worst, they were complicit. And then after this happened, the state has been completely unable to hold anyone accountable, at least anyone who matters. It's a crisis of legitimacy.
Exactly. There's, you know, there are some material relations between people and the political leaders that maintain legitimacy. But there's also just the popular perspective around what's happening and who's responsible for it. When the port blast happened, it was kind of this moment where everyone realized there is no value for human life in Lebanon. People in power don't care about us, even to protect us from a, you know, pseudo nuclear explosion in the middle of the city. It was a moment where, you know, alienation or desperation, hopelessness, depression skyrocketed. It became almost a reality all over the country, you know. At the end of the day, a depressed population is the worst outcome you can have. A poor and depressed population, even way worse. So the result of all of these conflicts have been, you know, shaking up the legitimacy of the ruling class. However, this doesn't mean that they haven't kind of used all of this time to push back with their own agendas, with their own political discourse, etc.
Right. There is a new reality in Lebanon. All of those fears, you know, if we think back to the 2018 election, there were legitimate economic fears about what was happening, and clearly things were not going that well. But now things have changed demonstrably for the worse. So the ground is much different for these political parties. But they, I mean, they're not dumb. The top politicians in this country are not stupid. We can see that they've adapted their strategies, in some cases quite cleverly, to the new situation, to the new ground. And one of these things, obviously, we're going to be getting much more into this in future podcasts, but you know, one of the things is sort of painting themselves for quite a few of the politicians and movements, painting themselves as being outside of the government. Oh, that's not really us. Or, oh, when the Beirut port explosion happened, like, that wasn't us, that was Diab's government, that was technocrats, you know, stuff like that.
And also some political leaders or parties were hit harder than others and have to deal with the situation differently. So, for example, the biggest event we saw ahead of this election was the withdrawal of Saad al-Hariri and the Future Movement, at least official withdrawal, because there are some former Future Movement figures who are running here and there. But Hariri said, I am announcing a pause of all political activity for me and the Future Movement, and he called on Future Movement members to do the same, to basically sit aside for this one in a way. To what extent people who supported Hariri before will abide by this or not, it's a question that we will answer after the elections. Similarly to Hariri, another party that is seen to have lost a lot of support is the Free Patriotic Movement, Jibran Basile's party, Michel Aoun's party. And this is why today, when we talk about the electoral scene in terms of the chances and stuff, we see that the main vacuums or the main opportunities are perceived to be in these two places, where Hariri has lost support and where FPM might lose support. We will talk about that and the implications of that in the next episode and future ones. But this is a very important reality to understand right now. And Hezbollah, Lebanese forces, Amal, etc., these are parties that might even maintain or increase their representation. Not increase in the case of Hezbollah and Amal, because the sectarian system limits how many MPs they can have. But for example, for the Lebanese forces, it's portraying itself now as the Christian alternative, you know, trying to take back what the FPM might be losing. And similarly for the opposition forces, they will be looking at these vacuums, at these opportunities as well to come in and break through.
Yeah, I think that this is actually quite fascinating, this adaptation that we see, because this plays into their positioning in terms of like their rhetoric, which seems to be going back to, in a lot of cases, sort of like this March 14th, March 8th vibe, which is very, I don't know, interesting, because it's like, well, how much have things really changed? But we also see this in the alliances that they make with each other in different constituencies. And that's something that we'll be getting into much more specifically in the next episode. So make sure and come back for that. I really hope that this has been a good overview of sort of how we are looking at the elections and looking back at, you know, what has happened over the last 4 years to, in many cases, change what's gone on. But, you know, in many other cases, sort of the ways that things have stayed the same. It's really good to be back with you, Nizar.
Same here, man. I'm excited for the next episodes as well. And really hope this this is helpful. We're trying to step back and offer a certain big picture, because we might be, all of us might be lost in the details in these confusing times. We'll be back next week and the week after and the week after. This time we're not messing around. We will be back. And by election time, we will have 4 episodes of this limited series published. So until then, I'm Nizar Hassan.
I'm Benjamin Red.
And this has been the Lebanese Politics Podcast.
The Lebanese Politics Podcast is brought to you by me, Benjamin Red, Nizar Hassan, who also produces it. And the music was by Omar Al-Fil.